You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Scott Tobias,
Tasha Robinson.
Genevieve Kosky cannot be with us this episode because of rights issues related to the Iranian Revolution. Every week we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week we're cheating a little as we're technically tackling two new films, but they're also two old films, sort of. And they're both two lost films seeing the light of day, although one remains a little more lost than the other. It's confusing. Tasha, can you help untangle this?
I can try. In our first episode, we'll be looking at Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, a film he worked on from 1970 through 1976, but ultimately had to leave unfinished. Why did it take so long? Why did he leave it unfinished? And why are we seeing it now? And on Netflix, of all places? We will get into that. But the short answer is that making movies is always hard, and some films are harder to make than others. And some are disastrous, as Sandy Tan discovered the hard way. As a movie-mad teenager in Singapore, Tan set out to direct and star in a surreal road movie about a serial killer. And she did, but then she lost the entire movie through no fault of her own. Her new film, Shirkers, is a documentary about that experience. We'll get into that story next week, but it's worth noting that even more than most movies, it's worth going to Shirkers unspoiled. And right now, it's just a click away on Netflix.
It's going to be an unusual couple of episodes addressing a couple of unusual movies. This week, we'll talk about Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, a film completed years after his death and designed to feel fractured even if he had been able to see it through. Then, next week, we'll discuss Shirkers, the film Tan made 25 years after her original Shirkers fell through. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Jay can't afford.
The Ernest Hemingway of the cinema.
Mr. Hannaford.
I just want to know what he represents.
The man is infested with disciples. I'm the apostle.
Just like me and God, how could you tell us apart?
Hannaford's new movie?
The Other Side of the Wind.
What's that about the movie?
We don't talk about the movie.
So you old guys are trying to get with it. Is that what this movie's about?
Well, we don't actually know.
What do we know? Jake is just making it up as he goes along.
He's done it before.
Movies and friendship. Those are best friends.
Mr. Hannaford, could you please slow down?
Mr. Hannaford!
What he creates, he has to wreck. It's a compulsion.
Want me to bring you another scotch?
We'll have our own movie! A real movie!
The Other Side of the Wind.
Well, here it is. If anybody wants to see it.
When Orson Welles died in 1985, conventional wisdom had settled on an assessment of his career. At age 25 in 1941, he made what was long considered the greatest film ever made, one filled with groundbreaking techniques used in service of a quintessential American story. But he never topped that film, Citizen Kane, and he spent the rest of his career on a downward slope. Like much conventional wisdom, this summary of his career was a gross oversimplification at best. Welles never stopped trying to push his filmmaking craft forward. He just kept meeting roadblocks along the way. His next feature, The Magnificent Ambersons, is a masterpiece hobbled by studio interference, and that set the pattern for much of the rest of his career. He didn't get smaller, Hollywood did, which led him to seek work and money elsewhere. That came with its own challenges, movies left unfinished and major achievements left for dead. But he never lost it. For proof, look no further than his elegiac 1965 Shakespeare adaptation Chimes at Midnight, or the unclassifiable 1975 documentary F for Fake. Then there was The Other Side of the Wind, the loudest of the ghosts haunting Welles' filmography. Welles began the film after returning to America in 1970, and it was supposed to represent a fresh start, a chance to reclaim a spot in a Hollywood dominated by new talents that revered him, but didn't see him as a contemporary. So he decided to outweird them, making a movie called The Other Side of the Wind, about an aging film director making a movie called The Other Side of the Wind. Welles opted to shoot the film in a radically discordant style, as if assembled from footage shot by the many camera-toting attendees of director Jake Hannaford's 70th birthday party, whose ranks include real-life directors such as Claude Chabrol and Dennis Hopper, characters model actor Pauline Kael, John Milius, Mickey Rooney, Marlena Dietrich, and others, and Peter Bogdanovich playing a Hannaford acolyte whose success threatens his one-time master. Then, as the film works towards Hannaford's suicide, it occasionally interrupts the bickering and chaos of the festivities with scenes from Hannaford's in-progress film, a baffling but beautiful pastiche of European arthouse directors in general and Michelangelo Antonioni in particular. Welles shot the film on and off for 6 years, and its production has become the subject of a good but superficial documentary that's also now on Netflix called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, and an even better book by Josh Karp called Orson Welles' Last Movie. The behind-the-scenes stories are pretty remarkable, capturing a director working without enough money to realize his vision, but determined to realize it anyway. And sometimes that vision shifted a bit. Welles, who insisted the film wasn't the least bit representational of his life, initially took the part of Hannaford himself for off-screen readings. Then he handed the role off to John Huston, maybe the only other actor-slash-filmmaker capable of playing such a larger-than-life role. Bogdanovich took over a role originated by impressionist Rich Little, who left the shoot under still murky circumstances. The shoot stretched on and on as the money came and went, and when Welles finished shooting, he still couldn't finish the movie, which became the subject of legal disputes too complicated to get into here, at least some involving money tied up in Iranian banks after the 1979 revolution. Now it's been finished for him, completed by referring to a partial rough cut in Welles' notes. How does it look? Strange, honestly. There's some mental gymnastics involved in watching the movie, which doesn't feel like a 2018 film, but doesn't really play like a product of the 70s either. There's nothing else really like it, either in Welles' filmography or in the new Hollywood landscape in which he was hoping to find a place. It's a singular, confounding, sometimes overwhelming piece of work, one that suggests Welles is willing to pursue his inspiration to some dangerous places all the way to the end of his life. It's further evidence, however belatedly presented, that he didn't lose his way after Citizen Kane. Everyone else just struggled to figure out where he was going.
Mr. Utterland, is it true you're planning a Western?
This is Mr. Hannaford's night. Let's save the questions for him, huh? You two are very close, aren't you?
Yes, I'd like to ask you about that.
Why?
Come on, Utterland. Why do you think you have to be as rude as he is?
As rude as you are, in print anyway.
I liked your last
one. Yeah, sure.
No, I know that it was repetitive, but... it worked.
Yeah, well, she wasn't that kind to me in her review. Not that you did me too much harm. I mean, how much harm can you do to the third biggest grocer in movie history to make that much? How marvelous.
Yes, did you know that when his own production company goes public, that your friend there stands to walk away with $40 million?
Yeah, and I'm going to say that I'm going to keep on writing that I stole everything from you, Skipper. I'm never going to walk away from that.
But it's all right to borrow from each other. What we must never do is borrow from ourselves.
Come on.
All right, everyone. As I said before, I saw this film a little bit ago, and I've been dying to talk to people about it. So, and I haven't really talked to anyone else about it. So I want to just kick it off. What was everyone else's impression of this film?
I'm fascinated by it. It's this incredible cultural object. It's so autobiographical. It's so unique in terms of Welles' work overall. It's so personal. It's a film that feels like a reflection both on what was happening in Hollywood at the time, New Hollywood, sort of these young mavericks that were coming along, but also about European auteurs, and it's savagely funny about both areas, but at the same time, it's also baffling and difficult and hard to track, and I don't know what to think of it. Really, I like it. I think, and I appreciate. I think there's a lot of there, but it is it's a mess.
That is not where I thought you were going to end that.
Yeah,
no, speech.
I mean, it's a good mess, but it is chaotic and incomplete.
Yeah, yeah, I think that that's a big part of it. I think it would be easier. I feel like talking about the quality of this film just seems like such a red herring to chase, because, you know, the director didn't make it, didn't finish it. And we're working from notes and ideas and a lot of half finished stuff. And I have to think the final version of this would have been tighter. As it is, it's overwhelming, which contributes, I think, to that era of fascination. There's so much going on. There's so much to mine here about the time and place and the experience of being Orson Welles, I think, or really just the experience of being famous to a certain degree and having to live that down your entire life. But mm-hmm. there's so much of this film that just feels like standing in the center of spotlights and cameras and interviewers and people who are trying to pry you apart and find out what's inside. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a horror movie in a way. I mean, it's assaultive. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that it's fascinating. I don't know that it's a good film. But I don't know that there's a point in talking about whether it's, well, we can talk about whether it's a good film.
You could. I think
we should, yeah.
You could maybe call it, the film that came to mind for me was 8.5.
It's probably, sure.
Maybe, it's maybe his version of what 8.5 is, but.
Or Mother. I mean, so yeah. much of it kind of feels like the last part of Mother once they get to the Hanford House.
The Aronofsky film?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think he traveled through time to be influenced. But I mean, it's weird with this movie. A lot of footage from it had leaked out before. There's a documentary on the F for Fake Blu-ray and DVD that contains quite a bit of it. I think the Chuck Workman movie Magician, I believe it's called, the Orson Welles documentary, has some stuff in it from there. I'd read Josh Karp's book. And when they screened this for us in Chicago, they screened the Love Me When I'm Dead before they showed us the movie. So, and there's, you know, it's footage of that in there. And yet I had really nothing really prepared me for what actually watching it would be like. It's a movie I'd read so much about and never thought I'd see in my lifetime. I pledged to they had a crowdfunding thing a few years ago to restore. I'm like, this will never happen, but here's my $50 anyway, you know? And yet to actually, it was like, remember, I'm looking at Tasha when I say this, remember in Sandman when there's that library of all like the books that were never finished or, mm-hmm. you know, it was actually like taking one of those volumes off and actually getting to read it, you know? So I was grateful for that. I'm not sure it feels like a finished film. I'm sure, and it was just nothing in any way to disparage the people who edited it together and the faithfulness they took to Welles's original intent for this. But I just can't help but there is a kind of shapelessness to it in a way that like the footage can be amazing, but it doesn't necessarily feel like it's been put together in a way. I think he probably would have found stuff in the editing room that he didn't find, that wasn't found for him necessarily. Yeah. I think it's a very noble effort, though.
I will say this, though. I think that, they were going on the rhythms of footage that he had edited together. And I trust that there was a scheme that he was working on in terms of the jaggedness of the movie and the mix of different formats, the very rapid cutting, the almost deliberate shapelessness of it. I mean, really being a 122-minute movie in which most of it is at this party where there's all kinds of things happening.
I would think the action, the narrative might have been a little easier to follow.
Well, particularly the jumping between there's a very large cast here of people who we get their names, we get their positions on the film, we get little like half story arcs for them. And then a lot of those arcs don't seem to conclude or go anywhere. And there came a point where I really had trouble telling some of these people apart. Some of them were more distinctive than others. Mm-hmm. But it's a whole lot of people who kind of blur. And I can't help but wonder if some of that might have disappeared in the interest of strengthening some of the existing plot arcs.
Or you could almost look at them like as a chorus or this massive representative group of people, at least at the party, who are acolytes and collaborators and, you know, young filmmakers, and they're all kind of just making the scene by being there. So really articulating those characters any deeper than it does is not really a goal I necessarily think the film has, so much as just giving you a sense of like what a party like this is like for the person at the center of it.
Oh, sure. I'm not talking about spending a lot more time with the characters who are here. I'm talking about spending a little less time with some of the characters who don't much matter. Mm. Like, there is a great deal of that feeling of being in the center of a whirlwind, but there are points where it feels like the story that he's trying to tell is better. Like, some of the scenes that take place between Hannaford and Brooksy, Brooks Otterlake, mm-hmm. come down to just like a very quiet point where the two of them are fencing, and you get the deep articulation of a very complicated relationship going on there. And I feel like there could have, with selective editing, been a little more of that kind of like directed give and take. Like, I think there's so much of the chaos, and perhaps more than we really need to get the point of it.
I'll tell you, I think he's showing a great deal of humility to be able to bring this film out into the world, and to allow something I think that is this painful to be to be exposed about the relationship between the two of them, which, you know, I can't imagine Rich Little playing this character. It has to be Bogdanovich.
Well, the thing they have in common is they both did impressions. I mean, Bogdanovich was famous for his impressions.
Sure, but I mean, yeah. but this character Brooksy is Bogdanovich, yeah. And this, and, you know, and when you get to that. I think quite memeable moment where he asks, "What did I do wrong, Daddy?"
Oh my God!
Which is just such a great line.
There's way too much mommy and daddy in this movie.
What did I do wrong, Daddy?
Speaking of mother,
there's a lot of sweetie as well. But I just think, like, you know, you think of that relationship and how Bogdanovich worshipped Orson Welles, and then he became this hotshot director who made The Last Picture Show and Paper Moon and just, what's the screwball comedy?
What's Up, Doc?
What's Up, Doc?
He had the world on the string.
Right, hottest director around, huge commercial hit after huge commercial hit, and also, you know, plenty of critical acclaim. And then suddenly, you know, he had eclipsed the master, and also maybe Welles felt like he cheapened art in some way, or gone commercial, but gone Hollywood in a way that Welles might have found distasteful. I mean, there's a lot of just raw professional jealousy at the root of this relationship, but
which in real life there's a relationship fractured, and be the custodian of this in many ways. You're right; it is an act of humility.
It is, and I mean, for him to involve himself in the shoot, to have their relationship exposed to the degree that it is in this film, and then for Bogdanovich to take care of this movie and to bring it out into the world. I get a lot of respect, because that is a hard, painful memory to dredge up, I would think.
Pshaw. Orson Welles said it wasn't based on reality or autobiographical in any way. So obviously it's just a bunch of stuff that happened.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. It's just about some filmmaker that has nothing to do with Orson Welles.
We should also not sell short. It's co-written by Ojo Kodar, who was his romantic partner for the last few decades of his life, and co-stars in the film.
Was it that long?
From the 60s to the 80s. Yeah. Okay. I mean, they were together for a long time. And in some ways, she became sort of the guardian of the film, but also in some way, as I understand it, part of why it wasn't released for so long. But one thing in the documentary, which I don't want to be too hard on when I say it's superficial, I just feel like maybe just slow down the editing a little bit in that movie.
It was kind of like trying to be a documentary version of The Other Side of the Wind.
It's just like, settle down. Just tell us a story.
Or F for fake. It's got kind of like F for fake elements. It's kind of faux sure. Both of those things. Go ahead. Sorry.
Tell me the story.
Yeah.
But she recounts how he credits her with unlocking an erotic element in his filmmaking that he never had before. And that's, you know, all over the film, within the film, which is kind of what I want to talk about, because I think that footage is incredible.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's kind of parodic, but it's also like, your parody is stunning. You know, and it's like, you could just make this movie and it would be a fascinating film to watch as well. Was that your impression as well?
I mean, I think the footage is beautiful. I think just sort of the, like, the impressionistic feel of, particularly of following John Dale around, just like looking in his eyes as he's experiencing Ojo Kodar is pretty stunning. For me, the film took a monumental turn when Hannaford's direction starts to intrude itself. Like, you have this relationship between them that just feels so 70s, so like grand and slow and iconic, and like they're both basically standing in for kind of like a Godardian type of cinema, you know, this cinema of image and of like these big iconic symbols of the, you know, the mysterious woman and the man who follows her but represents his own kind of very removed cool. And then all of a sudden you have Hannaford's voice slobbering all over them and making it dirty. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically something beautiful that becomes something obscene and unpleasant, because he's there as a voyeur deliberately messing with his actor's head. And I mean, that for me is one of the most compelling and horrifying things in the movie, is all of the things it makes you think about the process of making movies, and particularly trying to put erotic images into movies, but also just the question of like art tourism and what parts of a director are being expressed in sequences like that. The fact that it's a psychological game, and it's like an ugly, like erotic psychological game Hannaford is deliberately playing, brings a whole new like narrative element to it. But it was also just very squirmy to watch.
I find the film within a film just absolutely fascinating. It's maybe my favorite thing in The Other Side of the Wind, because I mean, the look of it is spectacular. I mean, some of the most staggeringly beautiful images, but it's almost like an airplane level parody of Antonioni. Like it is just, a brutal takedown of Antonioni, while also being kind of a parody of what Wells was thinking Hollywood films wanted. You know what I mean? Like what am I going to do to this film within a film to make it more commercial? Well, I'm just going to like start you off by having you watch the steam room scene and having my actress naked virtually the entire time, and inserting all some violence and these sorts of things. I mean, so you have it working on a lot of different levels, I think, both as a parody of high European cinema, and then also sort of a jab at Hollywood and what this filmmaker believes it is that Hollywood wants.
Yeah, it's so strange to think of this as a sincere attempt to find his way back into the Hollywood marketplace, which I think on some level it was and continued to be for a long time, something he really tried to get out there. There's that AFI tribute. Mm-hmm. You can watch the whole thing online. It's featured in the doc, where it's a tribute to Orson Welles. It aired in primetime television back when television would air such things. And includes like, please, I just need some money to finish my movie. And that didn't work. But it's odd to think what would have happened to this movie had it been finished and released.
Yeah.
I mean, how's it fit beside like Last Tango in Paris or something?
It seems strange to me that Welles would ever have thought this was a film that would get Hollywood financing. You think that the film is totally aware of that too, you know, because you have them screening it to this Robert Evans type who doesn't get at all what he's seeing. And what he's seeing is a good chunk of the movie that we're seeing. And so I don't, the idea of a film this experimental and crazily structured, even at this particular point in the 70s, would get a round of studio financing seems very far-fetched to me, and almost kind of a joke, but maybe it wasn't, just based on the AFI presentation.
And also just the movie itself is just so scabrous about Hollywood filmmaking and the pretensions of pretty much everybody who makes movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some really high comedy at that party, even before the party, when you have the journalists in the car asking terrible questions.
Yeah.
Just absolutely awful questions that Hannaford has no interest in answering. And then you kind of move that, like, that pretentiousness and heady faux intellectualism to the party, and you have all of these people kind of lording it over each other with like how pretentious and up my own ass I can be. Mm-hmm. I like, this movie does not feel like a movie that loves movie making or people in the business or people around the business or the process. Like every part of it just seems angry.
Yeah.
I think, except the film within a film, which seems, you know, distant and dreamy and completely outside. And maybe that's the point. It's sort of, on the one hand, you have, which I guess is often the point about movies, about making movies. It's just like, here is the art that's being made, and here is the ridiculous chaos and idiocy that surrounds the making of any art.
It's definitely an old, bitter, cantankerous person's movie, but I also think that it's a young film in certain respects, too. I think there's a excitement to it of Welles trying to reinvent himself. I mean, this is not, I think I've seen a pretty solid number of Welles films. This is nothing like anything I've seen him do.
Closest is For Fake, but that's a very different movie, though.
Yeah, no, right. It is. But I mean, it is true in that sense, like it's deconstructing itself a little bit. I mean, I think he was working towards something, but for him to do this, I mean, there's kind of an excitement. I mean, or maybe embracing more of a Cassavetes type of style for the way he embraces improvisation and kind of these formless but spontaneous scenes. I mean, there's something
that's overstated a bit, though. As Jonathan Rosenbaum, I heard him like talking about this film in the screening room. So like they really there was this, it was pretty tightly scripted. I mean, there's just moments that have to be like Hopper talking to, I think it's Hopper talking to Chabrol. I mean, that's obviously just a, you know, in some degree a conversation that's been captured, but I don't think it's really that improvised.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it certainly feels that way, though.
Yeah,
man, I want more of that conversation. I was a little. Like, I went into this movie without any expectations whatsoever, because I had a feeling it would confound them. But, like, I came away from it, like, my main takeaway was just, I wanted a little more of that conversation, like, with those filmmakers. And I wanted a little more of Hopper, like, at that age, talking about filmmaking and his filmmaking ambitions. It's kind of an electric moment.
It is. And before we say old, it's worth noting that Wells was 55 when he started.
Oh, yeah,
this.
You're not old. Okay.
I mean, it's kind of like in the same way that like he made Citizen Kane when he was 25, is also like he made this Angry Old Man movie when he was 55.
You know? Always precocious.
Yeah,
he had had such reason to be bitter, though. Like sure. he had been through the trenches in Hollywood by this point and back again.
Yeah, he had. You know what? Another couple of things this film reminds me of, because it's so steeped in cinephilia in general, is it reminds me of Clouseau's Inferno, right?
Yeah. Because
that was another case of a filmmaker who'd been associated with a certain period in French filmmaking that other French filmmakers had sort of left in the dust, trying to reinvent himself and make himself relevant and making something pretty radical. So it reminded me of that. And also
that movie, just a little context, it's a movie that George Clouseau could not finish. Years later, a lot of the footage surfaced in a film called Clouseau's Inferno, and it would have blown minds. It was like, you know, it's kind of like the hallucination sequence in Vertigo, like taken to the next level. And
like a whole movie of that.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
I guess the other one would be some of those late period Otto Preminger films. kind of like I need to figure out what the kids are doing, and this is what I've come up with. So it kind of fits into all that. But I also think like your reaction to The Other Side of the Wind is just the more you're steeped in Wells and the more you're steeped in films of that period and what he's making reference to, just the richer it's going to be. Because I think you come to this film ice cold or without a real sense of him or 70s cinema or European cinema at that time. I think I can't imagine this film would hold up at all.
And we've seen that reaction in some quarters of the internet as well. And it's
yes,
not,
we have.
Not a great look, because it's basically kind of like you're not really willing to try to meet this movie even halfway. It's like, this is not what I'm used to. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And to me, that's so strange. Just this film that was, I never thought I'd see is just now another option on Netflix next to the latest season of Daredevil or BoJack Horseman or whatever. You know, it's like, or you could watch this. That's whatever this is.
That's how video stores worked, right?
That's true. It's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
I mean, I think you have to come to it with a certain amount of enthusiasm for the opportunity to see it in the first place. Mm-hmm. Just an enthusiasm for the possibility of the experience. And, you know, as I said before, I think it's maybe not a good movie, certainly not a great movie, but it's an experience. It's an undeniable and fairly unique one.
Kind of a weirdly essential movie, especially if you're interested in Wells. This is an amazing thing to be able to see this, and just a fascinating new chapter in a story that we thought was over.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like almost like this Rosetta Stone type of movie.
It really does. You know, it's curious about that. I was just sort of thinking, like, the beginning of it with where the cameras are all pointed at, you know, flashes are going off and all of the different snatches of dialogue are going off, and it's just, as I say, it's completely overwhelming. I had a period of just like, I don't want to be here. I feel up against the wall and completely assaulted by this film. But the more it unpacked, the more I was like, is this just like Orson Welles telling us what he was always about? And like going back and looking at his filmography, like out of nowhere, I started to think about the degree to which his movies are about looking for truth, about, you know, mysteries being unfolded. And like, you know, Touch of Evil is about like looking for the truth of what happened in this situation at the beginning. Falstaff is about, you know, a character who builds lies around himself. And at the end, when he's stripped down to the truth, it destroys him.
Yeah.
You know, Citizen Kane is essentially about the question of like who this man is and all of these people trying to figure out who he really was. And then here you just have this man who's an this man who's an enigma wandering through a huge crowd of people who are all trying to get their teeth into him and pull him apart. And then there's sort of the question of, is there anything really there? When you find out what there is there, it destroys him.
Yeah, well, it's almost kind of like with him that, you know, I mean, you with Citizen Kane, you find out what Rosebud is and everything becomes very tangible. But here it's just like, you know, later in the career with like this and effort fake, it's like a rug gets pulled out from under you and it reveals another rug that also gets pulled. And it's just, it never ends. It's like this, I guess, magic trick, as he likes to put it, where it's just, there's no, it's very slippery to kind of figure out what exactly it is that's being revealed ultimately.
Yeah, but F for Fake is also just fundamentally about the search for the truth and whether it can be found. I mean, like that in and of itself also seems a little like a Rosetta Stone. Also, I think I just called Chimes at Midnight Falstaff.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. We all got it.
Okay.
We should talk about Houston, who I...
Oh, my God.
Was playing like some sort of like collection of tics from Wells and Ernest Hemingway and from himself. And I think maybe himself above all. I mean, it is... And Houston was such a gregarious figure. And I think he's terrific in this movie. I can't really imagine anyone pulling it off. Maybe not even Wells.
I can tell you one person who would pull it off.
Who?
Jason Robards.
Yeah, huh. Yeah, Robards would have been great.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's the only one.
Okay.
But also, it's just meaningful that it's John Huston.
Yeah, I think it does add that extra layer to it as well.
Yeah.
Just because he's like this huge towering figure that was a filmmaker himself, and he's got the same kind of old line quality or more to it.
Yeah, and just sort of like, you know, like Wells, he's there's a whole, you know, all this lore just around of his filmmaking adventures, his travels abroad, the shoots that are as fascinating as the actual films that they led to.
It's kind of incredible, though, that Huston still had more bullets in the chamber.
A lot. I mean, he had not even made Man Who Would Be King at this point.
Was that 75? I mean,
that was just it. I mean, he had commercial hits still in a way that Wells never would. And makes me think, you know, Houston could work within the system. Could Wells have changed enough to make Annie? I don't know.
Well, I mean, though, yeah, that's true. I don't think they really have a whole lot in common as directors, not really. At all. I mean, Houston is kind of your famous argument against the auteur, or the sort of, you know, he's the one who's always left out of that conversation. We talk about auteurs because he's somebody who doesn't have this kind of traceable style that auteurs really clung on to. He just happened to just have a collection of really good films under his belt, but he was never anybody who did a huge amount of experimentation, though he did some. I mean, if you look at a film like, you know, Fat City or Wise Blood or some of these later films.
Wise Blood's a really odd movie. I mean, you know, it takes a lot of courage to turn The Dead into a feature-length film.
It's a
novella-length experience. It's mostly just, you know, kind of like this, just someone going to a party in a way, you know. That's a tough thing to...
That's his last movie. Annie aside, maybe Victory people didn't like that much, but like, you know, Wise Blood, Man Who Would Be King, Pritzi's Honor, you know, he had a good... Under the Volcano.
Well,
I mean,
I'm just
talking about later
end.
Films. Oh. Yeah. No, I mean, oh, if you go back even further,
you
really get some great stuff. Yeah.
Just an incredible run just in a few years in the 40s and 50s.
Oh my gosh, you sure did.
You know, but to me, he's always Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings.
Is he?
Oh, I'm serious.
The Bakshi?
The Bakshi version. He was Gandalf. And
that
when
voice
he,
is commanding.
It's such a distinctive voice. And like in that movie, in Lord of the Rings, like he's forever talking in like fantasy aphorisms, basically. You know, do you want to go on a grand adventure? And there are so many points in this movie.
Pretty good, Tasha.
There's so many points in this movie where he kind of drops out of baiting people and abusing people, and he'll just drop these little aphorisms. And every time he did it, I thought he was about to pull out his Gandalf the White hat and put it on, because he has these moments where he drops into wise old man mode. And it's always a little chilling.
And leveling, too, in this film, too, the way he's able to kind of absorb all of this action around him without saying much. And then when he does say something, it just feels like it just cuts like a knife.
I'm actually in control of this whole situation.
Yeah.
Do you buy the suicide? I mean, I know he's a Hemingway-esque character, but it never quite feels like that tracks. the suicide at the end.
It does for me. I think your Pauline Kael character kind of lays bare his illusions.
Mm.
And particularly in light of what happened with his movie, The Other Side of the Wind, he can't get it funded. It's fallen apart in a way that it really seems like he did it deliberately. It seems like he pushed his leading man to the absolute edge and drove him away. And it seems like in the moment where it's happening and he's saying, you know, keep the camera on him and he's kind of glorying in it, it feels like he did it on purpose. You know, it feels like he tormented this man to get an emotional reaction out of him because he couldn't get the kind of emotional reaction out of him that he wanted. And then that moment at the end of the gas station, it's like he has been disguising his sexuality and subverting his sexuality for so long. And then he tries, like, just very gently to reach out to another living person and he's rejected. And in that moment, it seems to me like, what does he have? He doesn't have his career. He doesn't have his reputation. He has all of these sycophants who don't understand him and, again, just want to get their teeth into him. He doesn't have anybody who seems to, like, care about him for himself. I absolutely buy the suicide.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm with Tasha on that. I mean, and if you think about it, it's like, I was comparing it to 8.5, but with 8.5, you're dealing with a director who's at the top of his game in the middle of his career, and everyone wants a piece of him. But here they do, they want a piece of him, but more like a vulture. Like, vultures want a piece of you, you know, like carrion birds. I mean, there's nothing left for him to accomplish. Like, he's being thwarted in everything that he does, as Tasha says. So I thought that was plausible. I mean, he's 70 years old. What else does he, what does he have to really live for?
I guess, kind of before we wrap up, because Keith's got that wrappy-uppy kind of look on his face.
No, it's more the, should we wrap up? Because I can keep going. This is the thing we talk about.
I'm just curious whether this movie has a hero. Or even a protagonist. Like, is there, I'm not sure that there's anybody in this movie that I sympathize with particularly closely. I feel like they're all different degrees of awful. And many of them are fascinating degrees of awful. Like, I thought Julie Rich was a really interesting and rich character. I thought Zara Valesco was a really interesting and rich character. Like, I really feel for, was it Billy that's the reformed drunk who falls off the wagon at the end?
Yeah. I think so.
The Baron, like, has this certain, like, distance to nobility. And, you know, you feel for aspects of what Hannaford's going through.
What about Brooksy? Mm-hmm. Nothing? Nothing for Brooksy?
Poor,
put upon Brooksy?
I feel like Brooksy feels like he's the cynic who's still having success, and he feels himself kind of above it all. Hmm. And there's certainly a neediness in his relationship with Hannaford, but I also feel like he's embarrassed by him. And even more so when he realizes that Hannaford is about to ask him for money.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of different complicated levels of need in that relationship, but it's not a particularly pure, like, relationship of admiration or relationship of wanting to help him. There's no altruism in it. It's very complicated. I don't know.
You know, I'm just, for some reason, I my brain is going back to A Star Is Born and thinking about how his suicide in relation to Bogdanovich's career or something like that. Anyway, especially that scene when Hannaford says, let me get another look at you to Brooks, which is a very strange thing for him to say.
We might want to, can we move away from suicide movies for three in a row?
I know what our next pairing is, and I think we are suicide free. We're cool. Not death free though.
No, suicide free. Well, maybe too much for us.
Okay.
I could accept an argument that Bogdanovich is that Brooksy is the hero, skeptical question mark, but that he's the protagonist of this movie and that this movie is about him navigating.
If it's anyone's memory, it's him. I mean, Bogdanovich gets the narration at the beginning, which is clearly a new piece of writing.
Yeah.
It references cell phones and
that's kind of the worst part of the movie.
Modern technology.
I don't know how you solve that problem, but I was kind of like thrown off by that bit of narration. That seemed like the late period Bogdanovich rather than when he was doing everything right.
But I think if it's anyone's memory of the evening, it's his.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's not, but he's not in every scene either. So yeah, it's tough to say. There's more to talk about. I'm sure we'll talk about it next episode when we compare it to Shirkers. But first, a break and then some feedback. Now it's time for feedback when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else in the world of film. Scott, can you read one of the shortest pieces of feedback we've ever received?
Oh, sure. Sounds easy. Here we go. Aaron writes, mid-90s, kids, you're doing it, right?
Aaron? Yeah, we're not doing it. But we are not. We thought about doing it, but kids is, for such a looming movie, a much-referenced film, it's hard to watch these days.
It was hard to watch at the time. If you recall, you know, the Weinsteins had to make up a new company to get the film out into the world because it was such a controversial film. Because I think at that point, I think Disney had bought Miramax at that point, right?
Right.
And so they wanted to get a good distance away from kids because they're Disney. But my feeling is, like, you could have paired mid-90s with any number of movies. You could have you could have paired it with Clerks, was one I was thinking of quite a bit. You could have paired it with early Scorsese, particularly Mean Streets. There's a lot that you could have paired it with, some Gus Van Sant movies, Paranoid Park especially.
Good movie.
Yeah, it's a really good one. But what about
it's hard to argue that Paranoid Park is a dated classic.
It's a okay. It's really good.
Didn't that come out like 5 minutes ago?
No, it's been at least 10 years ago.
Well, I guess I'm not sure. What's
the precedent we always use for classic films? It was like
what was the closest one?
It was the one that Andrew Stanton directed that we did with the Mars.
John Carter.
John Carter, yeah.
The John Carter of Mars role. Okay.
We do try to choose films that you can actually watch. And Kids is not only not streaming anywhere, it is out of print on it never came out on Blu-ray, I don't believe, and it's out of print on DVD. You can buy it secondhand, but it'll cost you a little bit of money. So it's
probably streaming on the Pirate Bay.
Well, you know, that's
not the right thing to
do. We're not the kids, Scott.
Well, the kids probably want to see Kids, though, don't they?
Yeah, I would have been really interested in that pairing. I was very much enthused about mid-90s, and I feel like there's a ton to talk about. I really enjoyed that movie a lot, and I think it's really cool filmmaking, but even more so, it just, like, the amateur acting in it, like, that ensemble of kids, I found so believable and lived in. I think it's a really great movie. I really wanted to take it up, but we've just got so many choices right now. And it was hard to find space, and it was hard to find a pairing for it.
It would have been a really fun show, I think. I think there may have been a range of opinions on mid-90s, which I was sort of mixed negative on. But so that one made it interesting to kind of have a little bit of fighting between Tasha and I. It was a rare disagreement. And then and Kids, God, I can't imagine what Kids looks like now.
I didn't like it then, but I wonder if I'd like it more now. I've come around on some Harmony Korine stuff.
Yeah. I wouldn't always like the way Larry Clark shoots movies, but I just remember thinking, like, it was like Reefer Madness of its day.
Kind of, yeah.
I mean, its message ended up being, I think, an extremely conservative one, or maybe an inadvertently conservative one about hey, look at this, look at the kids of today. They're out of control, parents. Look what they're doing when you're not looking.
Yeah, and that generation grew up to just be wild rebels that changed the world. Oh no, we blew it.
Yeah,
all right,
we did.
We also got some.
But we're disaffected and cool.
Yeah, whatever, man. We also got some suggestions for our speculation about what a 90s version of A Star Is Born might have looked like. I threw out Mariah Carey as probable, I'm going to say, only possible female lead, but couldn't think of who else she could be paired with. Our listeners had some other ideas. Tasha, can you share some?
Sure. J.S. May replied, A Star Is Born? Forget Mariah and cast Whitney Houston opposite a Marvin Gaye analog played by Denzel Washington.
I can watch that.
I can see that. Yeah, that could have worked.
David wrote in, better than Mariah Carey for a 90s Star Is Born is Jennifer Lopez.
I still don't know. I have always felt like singing was sort of the second thing for her.
Yeah, it was always so that the studio really got in there.
Yeah.
And worked with that material, you know. It's like finding Jennifer Lopez behind all of that.
She could have played the part, though. I mean, she's a good actress.
Yeah, she could. She could.
Well, all right. Well, Christian suggested there was a 90s A Star Is Born. It was called Showgirls.
Yes. I feel like the human Drake meme or something. He just said, like, no. And then it's like, yeah, that's right. You got it. That's a pretty good point.
We should. Should we do Showgirls sometime? I mean, or is it just, it's been discussed to death, though.
I've never seen Showgirls. back in the day, I avoided it on purpose. Mm-hmm. And like ever since then.
Because you heard it was bad?
Oh, because I heard it was beyond bad. Also, I just, the advertising really grossed me out. It was just, it was an era where it seemed like the roles for women in film had moved from, you know, sidekick and reward to this sort of like garish kind of exploitation that was just like female sexuality. We've realized that if we empower you enough, you'll take off your clothes. And like that particular movie just felt like the height of it, like the height of tacky and over the top. And I just wasn't there for it. And then since then, I have never heard a single good thing about the movie. Except from my husband, who finds it hilarious, and like we quote it all the time, even though I haven't seen it.
I don't get sidetracked too much. It's a fascinating film. I think what you're referring to is not. I'm not gonna say it's not in the movie, but it's definitely much more in the marketing than it is in that, because like they tried to put it out as an NC-17 film, and I think it kind of backfired. Like I was a big Verhoeven fan, and I felt like if I wanted to see that in the theater, I'd have to wear a trench coat. You know, it just felt like going to see a dirty movie.
That's the other thing is I have a complicated relationship with Verhoeven, and I just don't trust him. Mm. I don't trust him with any form of emotional commitment. I think he's the words that come to mind are all ridiculously dated. I think he's a rapscallion.
That's pretty dated.
I think he goes
a rogue.
He might be a bit of a rogue. He might be a bounder or a cad, but mostly he goes over the top in ways that I find like that he intends to be satirical, and I just find like excessive and revolting and tiresome.
Mm.
And there have been Verhoeven films that I've really enjoyed and really been into, but there's an awful lot of them that are just like, I see what you did there and I don't want it.
So now, just for the sake of conversation, I'm looking for, we should find something to pair some Verhoeven movie with, if not Showgirls.
I think Showgirls is definitely going to fall in the bad category for you, just based on what you're telling me about Verhoeven. But I think you can, there's a reading of Showgirls as a commentary on America, on mm-hmm. You know, late capitalist excess, I guess, as people, the kids would call it.
And filmmaking and
but, I mean,
exploitation
itself.
Like,
I mean, it is ultimately a film about what America is, and it's this garish, exploitative, disgusting, money-driven, violent thing that is happening in Showgirls. So I think it's a very harsh film if you look at it from a certain angle.
Oh,
it's also
sure.
Also fun.
Whenever I hear the words, there's a reading of this excessive Verhoeven film where it's a commentary on excess, I just go, okay.
I know.
But they're always right.
I'm
though.
Just saying.
I think they're always right.
I'm just saying.
They can be right without it being a movie that I need to put in my own personal eyeballs.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we'll find a Verhoeven pairing soon.
Joe writes, longtime fan of your podcast. Thank you, Joe. I'm responding to your conversation on A Star Is Born from this week. On the episode, you questioned who would have been in a 1990s Star Is Born remake and questioned why one wasn't made in that decade. I believe it was, but just under a different name. That movie was Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights is about a young ingenue, Dirk, who everyone knows will be a big star in the industry from the second they meet him. In a clever twist, P.T. Anderson changes it to the pornographic film industry instead of Hollywood, but the same beats apply. Dirk is mentored by Jack, a once-celebrated director who is slowly fading in the industry as video technology changes how his films are made and received. We watch throughout the movie as Dirk's star rises and Jack's fall as they fight, lose touch, and then eventually reconnect. P.T. Anderson pulls from Robert Altman in his cast and staging and pulls from Scorsese for the camera movements, but the story is pure A Star Is Born. On the podcast, you mentioned how the gender dynamics never change in the reiterations of the story, but I think Boogie Nights does a nice job of changing that up by focusing on Dirk's rising stardom. Mm-hmm. Rising stardom. I bet he didn't mean that, did he? But I caught it. I caught it. He said rising.
I feel like I need to pat you on the
head. It's like an erection.
So what you're saying is that it's commentary on excess that is itself... I love this letter.
Okay.
I think this is spot on. I think this is really insightful, and it's something I never would have noticed. But I think he wins. I think Joe wins, and I think he's completely right.
It is a good one, though. I would say that Dirk's trajectory starts to What's the word I'm looking for?
Collapsed?
Yeah.
D2max?
His career goes flaccid, I would say. His career goes...
Yeah, it doesn't... If you follow it all the way through, it does not track all the way to the climax of the film. but I think there's still a lot.
I think we're now forbidden from doing an episode on Boogie Nights or anything sex-related.
Or Showgirls. My God. Are we all 12?
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But I think this is a fun letter. And I think you can just... Whether Showgirls or Boogie Nights, you know, is deliberately drawing from The Star Is Born or not, you can just see how much that story is embedded in, you know, in American cinema, right?
Oh, sure.
And manifests itself, you know, in unintended ways and or maybe intended ways in other work.
All right. Well, thanks for all the great responses. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations so we can feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll put The Other Side of the Wind next to another troubled production, Shirkers. Look for that next Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll see you on the other side of the wind. Yeah!